He accepted President Wilson's League of Nations as an excellent proposal if it would guarantee the security of France whatever she did, but he preferred a binding alliance of the United States and England to maintain, uphold, and glorify France under practically any circumstances. He wanted wider opportunities for the exploitation of Syria, North Africa, and so forth by Parisian financial groups. He wanted indemnities to recuperate France, loans, gifts, and tributes to France, glory and homage to France. France had suffered, and France had to be rewarded. Belgium, Russia, Serbia, Poland, Armenia, Britain, Germany, and Austria had all suffered too. All mankind had suffered. But what would you? This was not his affair. These were the supers of a drama in which France was for him the star. In much the same spirit, Signor Orlando seems to have sought the welfare of Italy. Mr. Lloyd George brought to the Council of Four the subtlety of a Welshman, the intricacy of a European, and an urgent necessity for respecting the nationalist egotism of the British imperialists and capitalists who had returned him to power. Into the secrecy of that council went President Wilson with the very noblest aims for his newly discovered American world policy, his rather hastily compiled 14 points, and a project rather than a scheme for a League of Nations. There can seldom have been a statesman of the first rank more incompetent than the President in the agilities of the council chamber. From the whispering darknesses and fireside disputes of that council, and after various comings and goings we can't here describe, he emerged at last with his 14 points pitifully torn and dishevelled, but with a little puling infant of a League of Nations, which might die or which might live and grow, no one could tell. This history can't tell. We're at the end of our term. But that much, at least, he had saved. 12th. This homunculus in a bottle, which it was hoped might become the last man ruling the earth, this League of Nations, as it was embodied in the Covenant of April the 28th, 1919, wasn't a League of Peoples at all. It was the world discovered, a League of States, Dominions, or Colonies. It was stipulated that these should be fully self-governing, but there was no definition whatever of this phrase. There was no bar to a limited franchise, and no provision for any direct control by the people of any state. India figured, presumably as a fully self-governing state. An autocracy would no doubt have been admissible as a fully self-governing democracy, with the franchise limited to one person. The League of the Covenant of 1919 was, in fact, a league of representatives of foreign offices, and it didn't even abolish the nonsense of embassies at every capital. The British Empire appeared once as a whole, and then India, and the four dominions of Canada, Australia, South Africa, and New Zealand appeared as separate sovereign states. The Indian representative was, of course, sure to be merely a British nominee. The other four would be colonial politicians. But if the British Empire was to be thus dissected, a representative of Great Britain should have been substituted for the imperial representative, and Ireland and Egypt should also have been given representation. Moreover, either New York State or Virginia was historically and legally almost as much a sovereign state as New Zealand or Canada. The inclusion of India raised logical claims for French Africa and French Asia. One French representative did propose a separate vote for the little principality of Monaco. There was to be an assembly of the League in which every member state was to be represented and to have an equal voice. But the working directorate of the League was to vest in a council, which was to consist of the representatives of the United States, Britain, France, Italy, and Japan, with four other members elected by the assembly. The council was to meet once a year. the gatherings of the assembly were to be at stated intervals, not stated. Except in certain specific instances, the league of this covenant could make only unanimous decision. One dissentient on the council could bar any proposal on the lines of the old Polish Liberum Veto. This was a quite disastrous provision. To many minds, it made the Covenant League rather less desirable than no league at all. It was a complete recognition of the unalienable sovereignty of states, and a repudiation of the idea of an overriding commonweal of mankind. This provision practically barred the way to all amendments to the League Constitution in future, except by the clumsy expedient of a simultaneous withdrawal of the majority of member states desiring a change, to form the League again on new lines. The Covenant made inevitable such a final winding up of the League it created, and that was perhaps the best thing about it. The following powers, it was proposed, should be excluded from the original League. Germany, Austria, Russia, and whatever remains there were of the Turkish Empire, but any of these might subsequently be included with the assent of two-thirds of the Assembly. The original membership of the League, as specified in the projected covenant, was the United States of America, Belgium, Bolivia, Brazil, the British Empire, Canada, Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, and India, China, Cuba, Ecuador, France, Greece, Guatemala, Haiti, the Hejaz, Honduras, Italy, Japan, Liberia, Nicaragua, Panama, Peru, Poland, Portugal, Romania, the Serbo-Croat-Slovene state, Siam, Czechoslovakia, and Uruguay, to which were added by invitation the following powers which had been neutral in the war: the Argentine Republic, Chile, Colombia, Denmark, Holland, Norway, Paraguay, Persia, Salvador, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, and Venezuela. Such being the constitution of the League, it's scarcely to be wondered at that its powers were special and limited. It was given a seat at Geneva and a secretariat. It had no powers even to inspect the military preparations of its constituent states, or to instruct a military and naval staff to plan out the armed cooperation needed to keep the peace of the world. The French representative in the League of Nations Commission, Monsieur Léon Bourgeois, insisted lucidly and repeatedly on the logical necessity of such powers. And as a speaker, he was rather copious and lacking in spice of the Clemenceau quality. The final scene in the plenary session of April the 28th, before the adoption of the covenant, is described compactly by Mr. Wilson Harris. The crowded banqueting hall at the Quai d'Orsay, with its E of tables for the delegates, with secretaries and officials lining the walls, and a solid mass of journalists at the lower end of the room. At the head of the room, the big three diverted themselves in undertones at the expense of the worthy Monsieur Bourgeois, now launched, with the help of what must have been an entirely superfluous sheaf of notes, on the fifth rendering of his speech in support of his famous amendment. They were so often diverting themselves in undertones, those three men whom God had mocked with the most tremendous opportunity in history. Keynes gives other instances of the levities, vulgarities, disregards, inattentions, and inadequacies of these meetings. This poor covenant, arrived at in this fashion, returned with President Wilson to America, and there it was subjected to an amount of opposition, criticism, and revision which showed, among other things, how relatively unimpaired was the mental energy of the United States. The Senate refused to ratify the covenant, and the first meeting of the League Council was held, therefore, without American representatives. The close of 1919 and the opening months of 1920 saw a very curious change come over American feeling after the pro-French and pro-British enthusiasms of the war period.